market that all of you guys participate
in.
Emerging domestic market. It's a market opportunity to invest here in the United States, an opportunity that's been created by the fact that classes of entrepreneurs, classes of customers, classes of laborers have been overlooked and underfunded. And I think it's a very attractive market opportunity. And you guys participating in it, you've been doing a great job. When I look at some of the statistics about minority businesses, enterprises, your growth rate is excellent, and you've been not only growing in size and numbers, but also in revenues at rates that exceed national averages. But there's some challenges that I'm sure all of you are aware of. And in preparing for this, I was able to look at a speech that was given by Mike Mosco, who's the president of the CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. And this is how he described the challenge. He said, and this is back in March of this year, businesses owned by women and minorities remain relatively small, undercapitalized, and underrepresented in the more capital-intensive sectors of the economy. Greater access to capital and credit are widely reported to be the number one obstacle to faster growth for these markets. So I guess that's not a problem. And that's going to be the topic of our session today. The folks here, Tiffany and Donna, have done a great job in assembling a panel of experts to speak on this particular topic. Represented at this panel are individuals that have raised equity capital before, individuals that have placed equity capital before, and individuals that have started up companies. So I'm excited about participating in this panel. I hope you guys take advantage of the resources that we have available. So let's kick off with an introduction. So what I'd like to ask is, we'll start with Nemo. I'd like to ask each panelist to provide a short introduction and an overview of their fund and firm. And then I'll launch it off with a couple of softball questions for the panel. And then I'll open it up to you guys and make sure we can introduce you. Nemo?
Hi everyone, my name is Nemo Viso, it's short for Nemesio. I'm from Baton Rouge, Louisiana with a firm called Stonehenge Capital. We operate in 8 different states, and each one of those states we operate a private equity fund out of which we make investments in startup as well as later stage companies. We have a new fund that is, I think, quite applicable to this forum. That is our New Markets Tax Credit Fund, and we are actually in partnership with the National Urban League on this fund, and it's called the National Urban League Stonehenge Capital Empowerment Fund. This fund will target companies in low-income zones, as well as the other primary requirement that the company be minority-owned. So we are actively now looking for investments in minority-owned businesses. We will center our efforts around 6 pilot cities where an empowerment center will be established. Here's the brochure. There are a few at the table out front, and I would encourage you to take one and look at it. Visit the website. But this is a unique partnership opportunity that will target minority-owned companies that we are just now kicking off. We expect to close the fund in 60 to 90 days. And we'll be operating at that point.
My name is Alan Tatel. This is my third year here, I think. I am a partner with Norrell Mosley. We're a venture capital firm based here in Atlanta, Georgia. We're the oldest and largest venture firm in the Southeast United States. We invest in technology, healthcare, and business service companies throughout the region, usually $5 to $8 million. We look for companies with a little bit of traction, $1 or $2 million in revenue, and we try to provide them the growth capital to take the company to the next level.
My name is Michael Price. I'm with VC South. We're actually the opposite of Alan. He is the oldest and largest. We're the smallest and youngest in town. I started in a bad way in commercial banking for about a decade, and then I finally saw the light. I kept reading in the newspapers back in 97, 98, and 99 how all these people in Silicon Valley and elsewhere were becoming just filthy rich, having jumped away from corporate America and starting their own businesses. And so I took the plunge then and had a really lucky one my first time out, and I would just like to applaud each of you for also having that entrepreneurial spirit and be willing to jump in and take the plunge. It's definitely not an easy plunge, for anyone who's done it. We're a very small boutique private equity firm. We're kind of like an idea labs, if any of you are familiar with that entity. We invest, create, and operate startups, so it's a very different model from a traditional venture capital firm. I want to be honest, since you led the charge in your honesty this morning, oftentimes I've thought about renaming, instead of calling ourselves VCs for venture capitalists, I've often thought of renaming us into GBs for greedy bastards. Because, certainly... Certainly speaking for my firm, that is where we're interested in. I can't speak on behalf of the others. You might, they certainly might be far more altruistic than we. You heard David this morning talk about the three C's of credit, which is cash flow, collateral, and collectability. Anyone doing a startup is almost always challenged on those three factors. Venture capital is a very different game, and I would say that there are three basics to it, and those three are money, markets, and management. And there are a couple of handouts. Kelly, there's a little pile there, and there's a pile there, and a pile over here as well. If you could just hand those back, and just at your leisure later, if you want to see what a VC looks at in trying to make a decision as to whether to meet you and whether you're fundable and start to do their work on you, I think these documents will probably provide great insight into that process for you, and you can look at that later. Only a very few companies are right for VC, and we primarily provide that money to other greedy bastards who are very effective in leveraging that equity to grow a company fast in a large potential market space. My key message later today will be, if possible to grow without VC, do not wait for venture capital, because the odds of it showing up on your doorstep is very, very low, and we'll be talking about other methods to get into it. Some of our recent investments were in this first half. We did four deals: Biz Summits, Survey Execs, Industry Experience, and ICERC, and we'll certainly get into that later. So with that, let me turn it on over to Rick.
I'm not sure I want to try to follow that. I'm Rick Larson with SJF Ventures. We are a venture capital fund that has an interest in expansion stage companies with a $500,000 or more in revenue, and we also look for companies that are have disruptive technologies that often include environmental or workforce innovation. We're a $30 million fund based in Durham, North Carolina, and glad to be here again.
My name is Ben Dyer. I'm here on behalf of Jackson Capital. We are a mid-market M&A investment banking firm associated with Jackson Securities. This is the firm that Maynard Jackson founded some years ago. It's well known for municipal finance activities, and we're involved in really filling out the corporate finance part of that firm. We have primarily this year been focused on a transaction to start a bank. I know the previous panel was on banking, but you'll soon be seeing offices of Bank of Atlanta in town, and we were engaged to raise the seed round of financing for that. Put together a very diverse board representing all aspects of the community, and have been involved in a $50 million transaction to get that bank capitalized. So if you didn't find a banker in the first panel, pretty soon as we get our regulatory approval, we'll have another alternative for you there as well. Beyond that, we're looking at a number of transactions that are generally $15 million and up. We are especially interested in working with companies that are vendors to the Fortune 1000, trying to build up their finances and help them be stronger vendors to those companies. There's tremendous need for that and interest in that right now. In addition to being here as representative of Jackson, I'm also a general partner in Cordova Ventures, so I'm in the venture capital business. The bad news is our fund has been fully invested now for about 3 years. We have 11 companies and about a $40 million fund. Our largest investment is in an analog chip device company that came out of some technology literally across the street here, and have a variety of software investments and others as well. So we're pending our clock there right now. But we looked at about 5,000 business plans as we put that fund together, invested in 24 of them. Have 11 survivors, which is about where we think we ought to be at this stage, and have a good outlook for that fund. Third business I'll mention briefly is Innovations Publishing. If you have an early stage company, you may already be profiled in our database, but we have a database of about 650 investment worthy companies around the Southeast. It's made available by subscription to people in the deal flow. And about 90% of the investors and service providers who are involved in the deal flow in this part of the country subscribe to this service. We have sponsors like Goldman Sachs and RBC Centura across the street, ACDC, and Croft and Bender, a number of other firms that help us with that as well. So if you have an early stage company and you ought to be represented in that, there's no charge to the company. Anand Amin is sitting over here as one of our editors, and he can collect your information. And the service has been very effective in getting companies known to the deal flow community, if you will, and known to investors. So we have a number of vehicles of help to early stage companies with that. I could also tell you if I wanted to try to pitch you on getting a crown or something like that. I guess I'll stop with the three companies that are the most relevant to the subject.
Thanks, Ben. Ben had mentioned that with Cordova that they probably looked at about 5,000 plans for 24 investments. And since I've been involved in the business, that doesn't surprise me. I'm sure it's probably surprising to a lot of folks. The title of our panel is How to Attract Equity Investors to Your Company. So let me start with you, Ben, and ask all the panelists to answer this question. How do you define what's attractive to U.S. investors? When you look at those plans, what's the key criteria or the attributes that are necessary for it to be attractive?
Well, that could be a pretty long list. I'll mention one or two things, and maybe we can develop all those as we go down the panel here. But I think being able to explain the plan succinctly is a great indicator of its potential investment worthiness. And if a PowerPoint is more than about 11 slides, it's probably not a good idea. It's a general rule of thumb I've had. And I've seen them that are 150 slides sometimes, and those are the ones that almost never get funded. But if somebody has a crisply defined idea, you can explain it in about 11 slides, and talk about an exit strategy, so you can understand the basic notion that an investor is investing to get a return and an exit, then that's a good place to start. So let me throw that one out and pass it on down the panel.
Great. So let's keep going. One thing that really helps, we're kind of in the information business as investors, and one thing that's very helpful to us is if the entrepreneur or the person representing the entrepreneur is able to respond quickly to requests for information and is cognizant of the fact that time is sort of our, as Charles said, we have to look at hundreds of plans to invest in one, and so time is really of the essence for us, and so somebody who recognizes that and responds quickly and completely to requests for information is a big plus. There are others, but I'll hit that one.
On our side, it boils down to three things. On the real estate side, again, we've always heard the word on the street in terms of how much that property is worth. It's always about location, location, location. On our end, it's all about management, management, management. And so we take a very, very hard look at who's going to be leading the companies. We very rarely leave it up to chance in terms of those who just might apply and send in a business plan over the transom. We actively seek the president and other key officers on there. The other criteria that we might apply is that it's got to be an area that we understand. In our case, that's technology-based, business-to-business. It's got to be, in our case, a fast follower model. I've certainly put my money into a lot of early stage missionary work, and as all of you know, missionaries usually get the arrow. The sellers get the land. And after a few hard knocks, I learned that I wanted to be a settler. It's a lot more fun and it's a lot more profitable. And so it's got to be an area where we can be a fast follower. And the fourth area that we look at is something that will leverage the portfolio and intellectual property of our existing companies. And so those would be our four. Alan?
So you're a greedy settler.
Exactly. It catches on.
I don't fancy myself a greedy settler. I don't know why. I don't know what I am. But anyway, the thing that I think attracts venture guys and women most are two things. One is when you put your customer list forward, and hopefully there are customers for what you're doing, what gets our attention is these large Fortune 200 names that, you know, Home Depot is trialing your product, or that some other large entity has actually found some efficacy for what you're doing, even if you're not getting paid for it. That really resonates with us. And then the second thing that follows with that, you know, I agree with Ben, a short PowerPoint really works well. And then it doesn't have to be the most detailed financial model, but a financial model that sort of lays out a lot of the variables that you think are going to drive your business, so that you can show that you understand that this is going to be a substantially profitable business, and here are the drivers for it and how they work. And then just one last thing. If you can show that you've been very capital efficient, that's just great. You know, if you build some sort of business with nominal dollars, as opposed to, you know, going through a lot of money, which gives us a lot of pause on how we structure a deal, that means a lot to us.
I would start out with a plan that is properly funded to date. When we see a plan where the founders have raised capital with an angel network or from family and friends to seed it, and then the company's coming in, therefore, at the right time for us, a later stage, that helps us quite a bit. To me, that proves out that this company is well positioned for our capital at the right time. And many of the plans that we look at, we initially screen out or drop off because of that. Too early, not properly funded to date. So that's important. The second, I think second most important would be the, you know, does the plan solve a problem? Is there a whiz-bang solution that the company's plan is offering to provide? And thirdly is, we like scalability. I think most investors like scalability of the business model. A business model where growth can be achieved with relatively little additional capital investment. Companies that need a dollar to make a dollar are not the most scalable businesses. But, so, you know, software companies are very scalable. Obviously, to produce another CD or DVD of a software application is a scalable business model. And then I would confirm prior comments about management being the number one factor, an important factor.
Great. Okay, so let's assume now that you were able to get the investor initially attracted to your deal. Alan was wondering if you can help us out here and just kind of walk us through the investment process at Norm Mosley in terms of how you guys take in deals and how you find a good deal this evening where you are willing to invest in the company.
Alan, before you speak, I just wanted to ask the panelists if you could project a little. It's hard to hear you back here.
Sure.
There's no microphone, but the room is designed to be heard.
No problem. You know, the chairs are a little low, so sometimes, you know, I just feel like that my feet are a vertically challenged guy, so it's hard to kind of...
You're a low beam,
so... Exactly. Walk out with high self-esteem after this, they get together. What was the question? Oh, okay.
That's the
process. Normally an intermediary will introduce us to a company, and that is someone like Charles, who's down here at the ATDC, or Tony back there, or legal counsel or your accountant, because usually you have a lawyer or an accountant prior to actually engaging with a venture capitalist, and they will introduce us to a company or an opportunity. Either they will send us a introductory PowerPoint and an executive summary, or you will directly referring to that person. It doesn't always have to be that way, but in general, having some sort of intermediate connection to a venture group is very useful and helpful in terms of legitimizing what you're doing. We then look at the PowerPoint and the executive summary, have an introductory call of some kind. If we like what we see, we either go out to the company to see what's going on and meet a little bit more of the management, or we have the company come in if there's not that much to see out at the company. A couple meetings, customer references, any sort of market intelligence that we can gather, if that all goes well, then we bring you in front of our partnership, and our partnership will then decide based on one meeting, usually, whether or not this is an investment that we want to pursue or not. If we decide that we want to pursue the investment, We will issue a term sheet which outlines basically all the parameters that are going to define the legal documents that we're going to put together. We execute a term sheet together. Then we do more due diligence, and we go to a deeper level, both on the customer, the business, the people. We do background checks. Sometimes we bring in industrial psychologists to make sure we understand what the team dynamics are going to be. We go to and then we also do a lot more legal due diligence, and if that all comes out well, that usually takes 6 to 8 weeks, you have a closed deal. There is one other iterative step in there as well, and that's that sometimes we bring in another venture group, and that is useful in terms of having more capital around the table, but that can add a couple of weeks to a month or so just to get another group comfortable with the whole concept. And we do that for a variety of reasons, which I can share later with you.
Just, I think Alan alluded to it, but one thing to keep in mind about venture funds in general, it's not true of every fund, but generally there's a committee or a group, the partnership committee. We have an investment committee that ultimately the person that you're dealing with has to sell the deal to. And so there's usually a deal champion within a fund. And so one thing to keep in mind is that you want to help that deal champion be the best champion that he or she can be for your company. So again, back to my point about information, and you want to kind of understand what the firm's process is going to be and really help that person who is championing your deal to the other partners do the best job with that. We usually say 3 to 6 months is the usual time frame for us. Often people talk about equity investors as being patient investors, and I think companies that are getting invested in also have to be patient with our process, so the patience runs both ways.
Great. As a preview to the panel starting, I had a chance to talk a little bit with Mike, and Mike was sharing with me a couple of recent deals that he's been involved in, somewhat excited about. So, you know, there's one thing for people to say what they do, but it's a difference to see what they actually do. So I thought it'd be a great example if Mike could share a company that he's recently invested in, he can tell you why he was excited about that, and you can get a sense of if your opportunity to kind of match those attributes. And then also, if Mike can share with us how he actually found out about the piece, because getting access to the people who have the capital, I think, is a major challenge for many companies.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Let me first back up and answer the first question that was proposed in terms of the process that's used, and then I'll show you how we related that to one of the four deals that we did in the first half. We follow a 5-step process over here. One is we target industries, and I would really encourage you to do the same thing if you're thinking about jumping in and becoming an entrepreneur and starting your own company. I would propose to you that creating the first of or that really neat in seed creation is far, far more dangerous than instead looking through the Atlanta Business Chronicle and many others, spotting which companies within there are growing very, very fast from almost scratch or nothing, really looking into some of those business models that are doing so well and are making the press. You'd be amazed at how open some of these companies are in terms of opening the kimono to Forbes and the Atlanta Business Chronicle and 100 other magazines and newspapers in terms of their cash flow and their profitability. Pick a winning model. You don't have to create that. You don't have to create the Ethernet, or the Internet to make a lot of money. Just find something that works, that's profitable and growing fast. And I would encourage you that you're 10 to 20 times better off, taking that approach than launching off into something new. We take that same approach. We're looking for an earlier fast growth market. We want to see typically 3 to 5 other profitable, cash flow positive, entities within that space who got profitable and cash flow positive very early before we're willing to put our toe in. The second area is on our end is that we actually verify and test demand. We'll actually go out there and we'll create a website even though the people aren't hired and the people aren't even aboard yet, and literally go ahead and contact some potential customers just to measure the volume of interest and how long do they spend on the site. Does it trigger follow-up phone calls or requests for for sales meetings, so we can actually gauge and measure on a metrics basis, you know, what we think we'll experience if we jump in there and back that entrepreneur. The third area is that we'll actually go through a strategic planning process with that entrepreneur to get a feel for how they think. So we'll sit there and we'll literally go through a full, you know, formalized, you know, one day long or longer strategy session so that we can really get to know, you know how they're thinking, instead of that, you know, where they just come in and do a pitch to you and present those 11 PowerPoint slides. It really helps us get a much better feel for how that executive thinks, you know, how nimble they are, what their experience is, you know, et cetera. Fourthly, we try to, go through a process of microfunding, once we decide that we're going to go out there and do the deal. And so instead of, forking over $4 or $5 million, you know, right up front, we'll pass that money, very, very minutely to them on a, you know, quarterly or monthly basis, and literally meet with them every single week for breakfast or lunch just to see how that plan is progressing. So one of the deals that we just did was a company called ICIRC, ICIRC.com. It services the publishing industry, specifically circulation directors within the publishing industry. The idea came to us from a veteran in the industry who had a lot of experience. We just loved his background. Really try to leverage in whatever company you go start with, some things that you've done in the past that you can leverage as well. We just love the resume, the management experience. We love the business model, and it was one, most importantly, that would really leverage the heck out of some of our other portfolio companies. One of the ones that we invested in a couple years ago is a company called List K that worked out really, really well. We were really able to leverage some of the new technologies that List K has been able to come out with to really accelerate that company. Went through the formal strategy planning process, with them, liked what we heard, could feel the experience, felt comfortable, and decided to push forward. So that would be an example deal.
Great, thanks. Ben and Nemo, I'd like to ask you guys to help us out with the situation. Again, you mentioned the 5,000 companies and 5,000 plans, 24 investments. So obviously, this type of capital, raising this type of capital, is not for everybody. Can Ben start, and Nemo, can you add in on how does a company, if I'm looking and I have capital needs and I want to decide if I should go to any of the players of our previous panel, or if I want to go the VC route, what kind of questions should I be asking as a company to make that decision?
Well, there's another alternative too, and that is to get a first round of friends and family money, and that term may have been used in the earlier panel, but there are active angel investors in this market. There's a group called Atlanta Technology Angels across the street, has about 40 members, and many of them are successful entrepreneurs who are looking to put some money into a company and perhaps get involved at some level, maybe as an active board member or maybe an active operator or something of that nature. So that's an alternative to get a company up and running. If you've exhausted your own capital resources, if you've maxed out all your credit cards, you've done all the usual things to try to get up and running, then turning to an angel may be a good strategy. The important thing there really is to find somebody who knows you more so than the reverse. So if you have people you've met through community service activities or school groups or a church or where, just anywhere that you have demonstrated to someone that you are a capable person and can perform well and are a good, upstanding citizen, and that person knows you or thinks of you in that light, that person's going to be a much more likely investor candidate than somebody you kind of dial up at random and try to go make a presentation to. So you can find somebody who knows you or some people who know you or sometimes who are related to you, and see if there's a way to bootstrap to some extent there. You may decide that you can get your company funded through individual investors like that. Again, seed round at the bank I mentioned earlier, we did that with what's called accredited investors. There's a test for that. It's $1 million net worth and so forth, a few other things there. And get to a private placement memorandum at some level, you need a little bit of legal advice. It doesn't have to be overly complicated, but there you have to go through enough of a planning process that you can go to somebody and say, I want you to buy 10,000 shares at $1 a piece or something. You have to come up with a packaged product to sell and see if you can find enough individuals to buy that. And I've financed a number of companies that way with a good success. Back through the 70s and 80s, I've been involved in a number of technology companies. The flip side of that is if you're looking for venture capital, really you're more, as what's been described already, you're more presenting your idea, the concept, and the terms generally are coming back to you from the investor. You're trying to get them interested in what you're doing. You may give them some guidance, like, I think my company's worth X, and so I'll sell you 25% of it for such and such amount of money. But really, the venture capitalist normally is going to come back and kind of tell you what they're willing to pay or how they're willing to value your company. So, you know, very different approaches. All of them require a clear thinking, some good working with the spreadsheets just to figure out what is plausible with your company. You know, all these investors, even if it's your mother, want eventually to get an exit. So you need to look at all of these. but that's frame of mind. The investors are investing to get a return and get their money back at some point in the future.
You know, there's been some talk about these startup companies being funded with debt to capitalize their operations, and quite frankly, I don't think that's a good idea. I mean, we see a lot of business failures because companies were improperly capitalized with debt that has a current pay obligation that creates a hurdle every month that has to be met, and it is not flexible or patient capital. So if you're a startup company, obviously equity should be the way to go. It's more patient. You don't have to repay it. You can reinvest your capital into the business to further grow it. Now, as a startup, if you're looking for equity, it may not fit either one of our funds here, quite frankly, because VCs tend to come in with larger dollar amounts, somewhat later stages of development. So where do you go? You do go to family and friends. And the reason those are excellent sources of capital is because they know you as an entrepreneur. They know you as an individual. And they've grown up with you. They may have been your babysitter. And these are people that are likely to make an intangible value assignment on you more than we could. And that has a lot of value. But it only has value to the right people. So that's what we would encourage. Startups and debt, not a good combination in most cases. Sometimes, if it's a franchise, if there's some contracts in place to guarantee income, that can help mitigate the risk of debt for a startup.
Rick, would you like to add anything?
Yeah, I think in general for a venture fund, your company needs to be ready to do a couple of different things. One is to grow pretty rapidly. I mean, in order to provide the kind of return that venture capitalists look for, including our fund, which is a multiple of their money back in 3 to 5 years. So your company's got to grow 25, 30, 40, 50, 100% per year. So you've got to be a pretty rapidly growing company to be able to meet that hurdle. And secondly, I think the key thing is that you are willing to take on a partner, because venture capitalists are interested in being an active part of your company. They want to get to the place where you as an entrepreneur and we as a fund, we have the same mission in mind, which is to grow the company as rapidly as we can, create financial return, in our case create good employment, or some environmental return as well, but that building the company so that there's a bigger pie for everybody, that's really what venture capitalists are about. So you got to be willing to take on a partner, and you got to be willing to recognize that your stake in the company is going to be worth more. Even if you have a smaller percentage of the company, you're going to have a bigger pie to share. And so I think being really willing to grow, willing to have a partner, focused on growth and building your value through the value of your equity and not so much on taking a lot of money out of the business in terms of salary.
Great. Fantastic. This is really, really great. So let's open it up for Q&A. And I guess I just got a couple of ground rules. It's just state your name and tell us a little bit about your business. And then let us know if it's a particular panelist that you'd like to address the question for the panel in general. And we have, we're going to do about 30 minutes for Q&A. We have many of the investors on our panel that need to start about 11:45.
Okay.
All right. So we will have to have a short little break at 11:45 for Alan to exit to a meeting, but then we can go to 12.
Further questions?
Hi, Alicia Brusso, Brusso Supervisor. And outside of NEMO, is it NEMO? You the only one that talks about having a program set in place now for women and minorities. My question is, I'm an engineering business, so the brain power by the hour kind of service. So who would one of you all do funding to minority female companies in this line of business? And so that's really the
Can you talk a little bit more about the size of your business and
so
I want you to follow too much here, but it would help to know generally sort of what your
dollar value.
Yeah, well, yeah, how many people you have and what your
we have some people. We are a small, female-owned business from here to Atlanta. I can go as far as that. Our sales right now are probably about 1.6, with a backlog of probably about 2.7 right now.
Now, this is IT staffing or IT work for hire?
Engineering. Looks like most everybody telling they're IT related. We're going to do all, look at engineering services, engineering environmental services, brain power by the hour.
We'd be happy to look at that, speaking on behalf of Jackson. It's more difficult for a typical venture investor to fund a pure service business, just generally speaking. Normally, a venture capitalist is looking for something protectable and proprietary and an invention of some sort that can be leveraged up and expanded rapidly. I defer to some of the other panelists on ideas for funding staffing companies. I have seen a lot of staffing companies grow very, very rapidly and finance in a number of different ways. I also have to be on the board of staffing companies in the allied health field. And, a little bit familiar with that, and covering an area of great opportunity. And I'd be happy to have a discussion with you offline about that and see if anybody else has any comments on that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to answer. And we've done a couple of business services companies. We just did one about 6 months ago called Biz Summits. That's now the fastest growing, you know, training company in the U.S. And the reason we did it, you know, most VCs have a real issue with business service companies because they're looking for some type of proprietary, you know, nature to protect themselves because the venture capital firms in and of themselves don't bring that to the table. They're really counting upon the business to, you know, to have generated or created that. We were able to leverage one of our portfolio companies that gave you know, that particular training company a huge leg up in terms of having, you know, lower marketing costs, and so that you know, drove our investment into it, and it's turned out very good. I know that if you really do a great job within the engineering services area, you can make a lot of money. There's I've got a fellow CEO here in town that used to run a company here called Lockwood Green. Some of you might be familiar with it. You know, it's definitely generated a lot of profits you know, through the years. That, you know, ups and downs sometimes, but over a long period of time, you know, time did very, very well. So, you know, business services like the one you provide, can be done right. I think that you would have a hard time, you know, getting, you know, funding from a traditional VC, you know, but there are some, you know, boutiques out there that would take a look at that and consider it.
Our fund has an interest in companies that create employment. So a business services company like Rylatel mm-hmm. Services, which we have funded, is one that we would definitely look at. We are looking for sort of disruptive innovators, so companies that are doing something really special, and it can be intellectual property, but it also just might be the way that the workforce is organized, or they have some environmental technology that's going to allow them to grow quickly. So I think we would be happy to take a look at your business plan.
Yeah, the previous session, a lot of success was giving consumers some of the hurdles that are faced with lending in terms of personal credit history, previous track records, business failures, things like that. How much discussion is given on the PT side to those issues, and how are those issues dealt with?
A ton. I mean, you know, it's just, it's we scrutinize that pretty heavily when we do a background check on you. You know, we will be finding out if you have some bankruptcies in your past and things like that, and that does give us pause, honestly. It's not something that will automatically kill a deal, but there's got to be some good explanation behind what happened. You know, so yeah, it's a real, you know, we were almost about to fund a deal that looked incredibly profitable in Florida, which is a big surprise. Even though I love Florida. Yeah, sorry.
we are almost funded a deal in Florida that that we were very close to doing. It's a very profitable healthcare service company. We ran a background check on one of the founders, and she had four aliases when we went through it. And one of you know, then we went back and looked at one of the aliases, and she had a bankruptcy hidden under the aliases. And so that was a very awkward conversation to try to explain, and that just made the deal fall apart. So it can really give a lot of pause.
And we're the same. The first thing we look at is management. And if there are flaws, it brings us, we've got flaws, and decide what, it certainly increases the risk dramatically.
Well, that doesn't mean that every business you've done in the past has been successful. It's a different issue than personal bankruptcies or background problems like that. And read a lot in California, almost more respected if you've had a few fail along the way. Demonstrate you can cope with failure and start again.
That's a good point.
One company that the Noro and our fund were invested in crashed and burned last year, and the entrepreneur there has just resurfaced with a new idea that has got a little round of funding just in the last week or two. Good guy, got caught up in something that just didn't work through no particular mismanagement or anything of that sort, and he's a bankable individual, I think. So, people that are in this game, nobody except Jeff Francoeur is batting 1,000, I guess, right now. So that applies to everybody in business, too.
Just a quick, I think maybe the VCs will let the credit slide some, understanding that some startup companies are funded with credit cards and personal loans. That may show up and show some stress on the credit bureau. As a result, maybe we're not as tough on the credit score itself, but we may even be more interested and concerned about character, criminality, ethics, judgment, past history. And we go through an extensive background check. We don't just pull a credit bureau, but then we actually hire a firm to do a thorough background check.
I don't even think we pull the credit bureau.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't go for a score.
Less than four.
And if someone has some issues that they think could have some concerns, or an investor could have some concerns about, when do they bring that up? I'm sure you don't bring that up in the first meeting.
You better bring it up in first
meeting.
That's a reflection. If you wait and delay and string it out, it's a reflection that you're trying to hide something. And again, that could be indicative of character, performance, judgment. So be real careful about that. If it's a major issue, some issues just cannot be resolved, but credit, bankruptcies, we can walk and talk through all that in many cases, and I think the VCs understand that some entrepreneurs have issues.
I don't know if I'd do it the first meeting, but if there is a level of engagement, I think you need to bring that up. But the way to bring it up is say, this is what happened. And I'll tell you, the CEO of one of our most successful portfolio companies was the CFO of a company that went through some huge SEC issues. Okay, just enormous public company fraud issues and all that. And he's the CEO of one of our companies now. And I think he's my best CEO right now. But what he did is we said, okay, here's the issue you need to know about it, and here's the four people you need to call to understand what my involvement was in the process. Now, he understands that we're going to do our own checks, but he wants to make sure that his side of the story is well vetted, and that's the way he sort of came around.
That's
right.
That's good advice. Okay, I'm
heading
over here.
My name is Tanya Clark. I'm
a dedicated
to the Incorporated. We're a child care clinic for underprivileged children. And it's a non-profit. If any of you know about being capital offending, it's a non-profit.
We actually have an investment in a company called fundraisinginfo.com, which you might access on their website. And they provide advice for that type of thing. And there are a number of companies that do advise nonprofits on how to raise money, but that's a very different process than what we're talking about here. And the investment there is not for return, but it's for the good of the investor.
There's also an organization called the Nonprofit Finance Fund, which, as its name suggests, funds nonprofits usually with debt capital. And I think you can find them on the web.
One thing that may be helpful to you, and first let me applaud you for the good work you do. I've got a daughter who has Down syndrome, and just wonderful work to see, you know, what caregivers can give in terms of love and education. So, you know, huge kudos. One of our companies does quite a few scholarships and also some financial assistance for certain nonprofits without asking for payback. In fact, we gave the CEO of Raytheon in Boston gave a couple of our scholarships out last week. So we do quite a few. If you want to contact me, I can put you in touch.
Right back here.
Sam Bruce and Star, SBIR fund phase two. Where would a VC get involved in phase three? We have gone through phase one, we're getting ready to go through phase two now. Is the VC a small business innovative research phase three, which is now commercialization and the solution? 2007 for us is when we were looking for money. What things are, is the VC the right vehicle for that, or is it something different from your perspective as you look at the technology part?
So is anyone in the panel familiar with the SBIR process?
Sure, we'll do it.
Okay, then whoever can answer that question.
Well, I mean, a phase three SBIR is a real asset that we'd love to look at something that's SBIR phase three. I mean, it means that you've made a heck of a screening process through the government. I mean, you know, for those of you who don't know, to get a phase two is what, 1 in 1,000 or something like that of the phase one. But I mean, it's to get a phase three is pretty killer. So
phase three is we're out looking for money from you guys.
Yeah, well, that's something we probably want to take a look at to understand what the commercial applicability is of what you're doing. You know.
So we sort of, again, funds have different stages that they invest at. So we consider ourselves an expansion stage funder, so we would look at your company if you had $500,000 or $1 million in commercial revenue. So we tend to, SBIRs are great, it's a great way to get started, but we're looking for whether you've got actual customers that are paying for your product, and that would be, when you get to that point, that would be a good time to approach us.
Hey Rick, the SBIR Small Business Investment Research, and it's innovative research, and it's a federal government sponsored program supported by several agencies like NSF, Department of Defense,
yep.
Usually provides funding for research that has some commercial appeal associated with it over a period of a couple of years or so. Mm-hmm.
Our phase one is $100,000 in seed funding, phase two is happening in 500,000. And you can get some matching extra money for that. Mm-hmm. Phase three is actually take the product to market mm-hmm. and chasing matching funds and commercialization. Mm-hmm.
I think that's important to say we do have an SBIR assistance program here.
Great.
Yeah, I'd like to say sort of a shameless plug for Star Software, Rick, and Alan did presenting this afternoon. So hopefully y'all are sticking around for the rest of the day to be able to see them talk about this business. And they also have a tax credit.
Great.
I'm Bob Burns with Ant Factory. We're trying to finance a entertainment or music-based business. We don't have any VCs that aren't interested in that market, and if not, how would you advise to collect funding or stuff like that?
VCs don't do music. But yeah, I'll tell you, my old boss at Mindspring is Mike McQuarrie. I don't know if you've talked to him or not, but Brash Music is his little label. You know, I would go to his website and see what you can see, but he and Kurt Ellis have backed some music-related stuff. They enjoy that. So.
And in general, I'd say that, you know, look at companies that are in your competitive space. Go on their website and see who their investors are. That's a great source of finding someone who knows the space. You can also look at some of these services like Pricewaterhouse puts out the Money Tree Report once a quarter, and they have a list of deals throughout the entire nation. And so you can look and see what's getting financed, and if there are companies that are close to your space, you know, that will be an interesting investment target.
What's the name of that report again?
So PwC Money Tree. And I guess you could probably get it at pwc.com. I think the URL is pwcmoneytree.com.
Great.
Okay. Yes, sir.
My name is Scott Coleman, and this is a message for all five panelists. Out of your existing portfolio, how many of those companies are minority-owned or operated? And are you actively seeking minority companies? And the third question is how you're going about if you are seeking minority companies, how are you going about doing that?
Great. Nemo, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, obviously, we're now starting to heavily market into this segment with that Midron that's minority targeted. And we actually do have a we have two minority-owned companies in Louisiana that we've invested in. One is PJ's Coffee, and the other one is iMinorities.com, which is a job search engine targeting the minority community.
I was one of the early people in the Emerging Venture Network, which is now part of the University of Virginia, which started a conference called Ideal Flow to try to marry minority entrepreneurs with venture capitalists. And I'd say Charles was a part of it as well. It's had some success. I'm glad it's part of the University of Virginia. We lost a grant from AOL Time Warner that we thought was really going to take us to the next level. But that was at least my endeavor to start off with. I have not done as much formally since then. That sort of wound down a year ago. I'd say we've got 4 or 5 minority entrepreneurs in our portfolio out of 30 companies, 35, and I'm talking both Asian and African American.
On our end, the answer to the first half of your question, Scott, is not nearly enough. If we look at, we haven't done that many, total because we're so young. But if we look across our 15, we've just got 2, and obviously that's not nearly enough. The actions we've taken is, I think I mentioned just a few minutes ago that we've been giving out a lot of scholarships. All of those scholarships have been targeted at minority inner city students, and in this last month we gave out 6 scholarships in Houston, St. Louis, and Boston, and we found that to be a very, very effective way to raise our profile to the right business leaders within those communities who are minorities, and that's really, really helped us get more applications and deal flow coming our way within that sector.
We have one minority-owned company, Rila Teleservices, and we actually heard about Rila through Nadja Ajay Drinks, who's here at the Ideal Flow event that Alan mentioned. I don't know how many years ago that was. 2000, I guess. So I think we're very interested in doing more investing. I think we're really looking for the very best companies in markets that are growing and that have real innovation. And if the entrepreneur is a minority, then great. And if the entrepreneur is a four-year-old white guy, then great. If the entrepreneur is a woman, fantastic. So I think we're agnostic, really. But if we do, one of the things that our fund tries to do is to provide access to capital to entrepreneurs and sectors and locations or regions that are not well served by venture capital. So the minority community is certainly a part of that.
Out of the original 24 deals we did at Cordova, we had one that would be classified as African-American, minority-owned, and probably 4 or 5 that are Asian-led. So we have quite a number of minority entrepreneurs involved in all of our companies now, but that's the statistic I recall at the moment.
Great. And Scott, I just realized I overstated. We did 4 minority inner-city student scholarships last month, not 6, and I apologize for overstating that.
Okay. Yes, sir. My question is for the minister. You mentioned, I believe, that your partner is in the Urban League and you're going to do pilot programs in 6 cities. Do you know what the city does?
Yeah, Atlanta, Cincinnati, Cleveland, Jacksonville, and Kansas City. Now, these cities will have what's being referred to as an empowerment center located in the city, which will be an office of business counselors, financial counselors, to help the entrepreneurs develop business plans and then find the capital and refer them to the appropriate source of capital. And this is now just being kicked off. And as far as nonprofit, I think that's a good question. The Kauffman Foundation is a major partner with us in this empowerment fund, and there really is a lot more interest in helping the minority community, and whether it's nonprofit foundations allocating dollars to these initiatives or the federal government encouraging this new markets tax credit program, which targets low-income communities. There really is a lot more activity, and I think everyone should be encouraged by that, and hopefully that momentum will continue.
Can you tell us about your business?
My name is Eric Walker, my company is Blue Energy Inc., and we develop and license a small part of the energy system.
Question would be, if you want where it comes through beyond the funding through venture capital and additional assistance required, say maybe in the introduction of a new product, would that be part of what venture capital partnership can augment that? There are certain kind of ideas that regular lenders might look at and help with. If you are raising fish on the planet, start saying you want to develop fish into a different kind of product, it still remains fish, but it might be relatively new to the industry. Will the venture capital be willing to provide the kind of vehicle that opens the door for that kind of product to get into the market?
Great. I'd like to ask Ben to answer that question, because I know at Cordova you guys are doing fairly early stage seed deals?
We did early stage seed deals, all technology based.
No fish deals, all right?
I don't think so. The purpose of venture capital, it really is to do things like that, I think, is to bring new products to market and make that possible. But the investment needs to be made in the context of a company, financial plan, and exit strategy, all things we've talked about before. And you wouldn't go to venture capitalists just to fund a specific product launch, per se. It's kind of an adjunct to something else you're doing. You've really got to take on that venture capitalist as a partner in the business. All venture investors are prepared to make subsequent investments in a company. So if you've taken in some venture money and you've grown the company for a while and you've got a new product idea that needs more money, then your existing investors, if they're happy with the partners today, are your first and obvious source to get additional funds to do what you're talking about. And that's an advantage of dealing with a venture capitalist as opposed to raising money from individuals, because most individuals write a check and they don't expect to hear from you again until you send some money back. So being associated with an institutional investor that can help you when you need more money for expansion like that, it can be a very good thing.
Okay.
Tiffany Piper, United States Security Services. Is there a market, or do you feel that there is a market for a company that does consulting for businesses using biometric access control, such as fingerprint, retina, facial recognition, for accessing buildings, and also for surveillance cameras? We all have experience in this area, but we have contacts, we have business on the table.
Who does security? I'm a little bit familiar with that. There's a company called VistaScape that's done pretty well. I don't know whether you're familiar with them or you...
We're actually working with them.
Okay, well, that would be my first choice there. And they are in the development of technology for security cameras. And I have done considerable business, I believe, with the Navy. I've got some funding, and that's a good place to start.
Biometrics, the answer is yes, but the market's developing very, very slowly. So, I mean, literally, the chip manufacturers for biometrics are finally getting some traction on PCs, and it's happening on cell phones, too. And that market's evolved even more slowly than people thought. Physical security is the next logical market, but when the uptick in that market's going to be, I can't tell you if it's 2006 or 2008. That being said, we're about to make an investment in a play that facilitates building-based biometrics. So we are bullish on the space overall.
Brian Ruby, startup Nav Technology Company. My question is, what level of involvement do VC firms generally want to have in the running of the company? I guess I'm hitting at control issues here. And I'll open up to the whole panel because you may have very different answers.
lot of it depends upon what stage in the life cycle that company is in. For example, I don't want to speak on behalf of Alan at Noro, but they might be typically looking for a deal that might have $3 to $4 million in revenue, somewhat established company in a fast growing space with great management. And I would think that they would give those people pretty wide autonomy so long as they stay on plan. If you're going to a VC firm or private equity firm in a much earlier stage, perhaps even at the startup or seed stage where the company isn't even started yet, the marketing hasn't started, the key people aren't aboard, you should expect a huge amount of involvement with that VC or private equity specialist to help the company along and get it started. And I would think you would probably want that that assistance, where a more established company would probably just want the equity at a best valuation they can get with minimal intrusion as they could possibly get. So and you find that whole range of cycles.
So Mike, if you're going to let you chime in. So what kind of involvement? So if you raise an involvement, so what are we talking about? If I have a $5,000 expenditure for a PC, do I have to go to my VC to get that approved?
I mean, to Michael's earlier point, we're interested in, the key question for us is, a key question is management. And so we're spending a lot of time vetting and doing due diligence on the management team because we want the management team to run the company. And we don't want to have to run companies. That's not what we're in the business to do. We're in the business of supporting and helping companies grow. And so I think, but we're a little bit later stage investor than what Michael's talking about, seed stage. So I think stage is real important. Keep in mind that we're an investor, and if you as management are not doing a good job, we're going to step in and make sure that our investment is we do everything we possibly can to protect that investment. Because usually venture capitalists are investing other people's money, and that's our job. So if we have come in and fired CEOs and brought in new CEOs, more often our role is to help build a management team. So to hire a CFO, to bring in someone with sales and marketing experience and build a company around the CEO. So nobody likes to get rid of a CEO, particularly the CEO. And but that's that's part of what we have to do to protect our investments sometimes.
And how do you do that without majority ownership of the company?
They're usually on the we don't have any majority positions in companies. We have protected provisions on our investments, so we sign off on very large decisions that the company's going to make about joint ventures or large expenditures or whatever, and we have usually in a board situation, we would have to convince the rest of the board that the CEO needed to go, or if we're if we had that protective provision in the legal documents. So.
Be careful what you sign. Remember that big print gibbets and small print tickets away.
I'm actually surprised that it took an hour and a half before we got to control. Let's add other questions on control. I know this is a big issue. Are there other questions on control?
Cooking and delivery of shipping foods. I manufacture African cuisine for Walmart Supercenters, relatively small company. My question is, my vision is to have like a Tanner Express type African food throughout the United States. I want to go IPO in about 6 years. I'm scared of venture capitalists, perhaps going the venture capitalist way, because I had a friend who had a pretty good company and was kicked out of the company because of the way they structured the deal. So can you please speak to that issue of control?
My partner Jack Kelly used to say that you can always divorce your spouse, but you can't divorce your venture capitalists. In the context of what you're talking about, a lot of chemistry between the firm and the individual is very important from starting off. In terms of selectivity, because there are a lot of some venture capitalists who are a little bit more you didn't make your plan, it's time for you to go. What happened, as opposed to someone who you think might be more collaborative and will work with you. And I think chemistry is really key there. Generally, the situation you're describing where someone loses their role in a company happens Is it because you're about to run out of money, or the path to running out of money is very visible? And it doesn't happen, I mean, it can happen in other times when the growth trajectory isn't what you think it is, or there's some other sort of, you've had some other propriety issues where we thought that the CEO was doing some things that, not borderline illegal, but we were going to get sued for them kind of thing. But in general, it's where you're heading downhill and you're running out of money. And that's when it's a little bit like being a general manager of a basketball team. I was thinking about Kevin McHale last year when, he didn't bother Flip Saunders for 7 years when he ran the Timberwolves as a coach. But as soon as they started to lose, he was all over Flip Saunders. And then he fired Flip Saunders and he actually came in and ran it. Or you'll find an interim coach to run it. That's a little bit like the model of venture. I mean, and it's just a question. But think of, instead of your one loss record, think of it as your financial performance and your cash position.
But given that the company started a company, even though I hear what you're saying, can't the deal be disrupted so that they are moving to another part of the company?
You know, it goes both ways. I mean, in general, you'd love to have a founder take another role. But usually what happens is that there's so much conflict and so much upset about it that either because there's been a new executive introduced to the process and there's some, it's either he goes or I go, sort of thing. That's a lot of times what happens is that we introduce professional management, and I say one time out of 10 it takes. This is the one thing that venture capitalists are not, just don't do well. I'd love to say otherwise, but we introduce professional management into a company, and we expect that the next day everyone's going to be singing Kumbaya together, and it's all going to work. And to work on that assimilation process and make sure it's going to be successful is something we need to do back. But in general, what happens is that one of the two end up leaving. It's not always the professional management. I'd say it's a half and half thing where the founder stays and the professional manager goes. But that's usually where the friction point comes in, and the two can't work together.
I would comment that there really is no holy grail because you're a founder of the company. If you bring in outside capital from a venture firm or other partner, the partnership agreement, the documents really is what prevails. So read the documents closely, make sure you understand them, hire the best legal counsel you can, and you can protect your rights, like we're also trying to protect our rights and reach a common agreement.
Someone told me that one of the things I could put into the agreement was if you have the right to buy back all the shares. Can anyone comment on that?
These days, so I take that callback provision and just go like that.
Somebody told you wrong.
When the going gets good, you get the
what price? No, I mean, it depends,
Like a point or two on that. If you take in venture capital money, that implies you're going to have a board of directors, and there's an art form to picking people to be on a board and to working with the board, managing their expectations, and maintaining a rapport with them. I have seen a wide range of different styles of venture investors in some of the deals we're in. One in particular brought in some very large institutional venture investors from different cities, and the board meetings went from being pretty high level collegial intellectual strategy type sessions to just be grinding minutiae, making the sales vice president go through every single prospect and give strategy for every single account. So that was a personality style, I thought. I found it very intolerable myself. If I'd been CEO there, I would have not appreciated that much second-guessing at a board meeting. So, selecting a board that you can get along with, as I always say, if you're thinking about venture capital, you need to talk to other portfolio companies in that fund to see how they get along with the partners in the fund, see if they're good board members and contributory, or if they're more getting in your way. But another thing to keep in mind, I was also thinking at the same time, I don't have my list of companies at hand, but the majority of our companies do not have the original founders on board. They have changed management a couple of times, but we've been through a 4 or 5 year really horrible down cycle in technology, and nobody looked good. So it's been very difficult to sustain a job during that period of time. That doesn't necessarily mean that will continue to be the case, but I've very often seen that, and some of that is just evidence that as companies go through growth stages, different skill sets are needed. I've been involved in startups. Peachtree Software is a company. I was the founding president. I think some of you are old enough to remember that. Some of you are not. But we went through a lot of evolutions of that company, and what worked great when we were 10 people did not work when we had 50 people. And so we had to make a lot of officer changes, and we got to a much larger size. And skill sets that work at one size company are sometimes just not right at the next. So eventually you've got to get people who can be middle managers, you can leverage up your business, scale it up, and they may not be the same people that you started with. So that's kind of a fact of life as you try to grow something very rapidly. And sometimes the venture capitalists get the blame for introducing those changes, but sometimes they're the right thing to do.
One thing I always, and we don't always get it, but I think one thing that I look for in entrepreneurs is whether they know what they're good at and what they're not good at. And to Ben's point, I think someone who knows that what stage of the company they're going to be the most contributory to and is able to say, I think I'm the right person for right now. When we get to 25 million or 50 million or we get to this size or we have to do this, I'm probably not the right person. And it's just real important to have a sense of what your strengths and what your limitations are, because that's how you can build a good team. And it takes the myth of entrepreneurs is that you can go out there and be the lone wolf and get stuff done. And to a point, that may be true, but I think building a team that can help you build a company as opposed to promote a technology is a very different process.
This probably applies to everyone in the room, and especially with your question. So many entrepreneurs, when they go to start a company, they skip the third source of funding, which I think is probably the most important source of funding of all. Typically the sequence is you yourself, and that might be in the form of home equity, 401k, credit cards, lines, all that stuff. You then go to the friends and family and tap them, and mom, unless it's Ben's mom who wants repayment, for all their work. You then want to go to the joint venture partners, and that's the stuff that usually gets dismissed. And David brought it up at the last session. That is the most that is the most important and the most often overlooked source to push your business along. Then would come angels, VCs, and finally banks, once you hit a certain measure. And so to take that into a street level strategy, if you've got food services, and let's say you've got unique recipes and brands, and you think that really has scalability, you'd want to go to the Sysco Foods and the food distributors and all kinds of partners of that nature who might not just look at it as an additional form or product of distribution, but might really take the ball and run with it, and even take on production, getting those menus and items introduced nationwide. They can immeasurably help your business plan, and they would be a far better source for you to go to than a VC that's looking for some type of proprietary technology where you'll really be struggling to address that at that point.
Great. Just 1 second. I know we're going to have about 15 more minutes of questions. One of our investors had a previous commitment,
yeah.
So I'm going to allow Alan. First, I want to thank Alan for participating in the panel.
Sorry,
any final comments for us? We'd love to hear them.
Yeah, I want to actually respond to what Michael said before, because that third level of funding, although can be very helpful, vendor funding is very risky. You just got to be really careful about it, because they put in two things. One is that all of a sudden the universe becomes a monopoly where you only have one supplier because you've sort of locked yourself in. And I've seen a lot of companies fail because of that. And then they end up with a right of first refusal to buy your company, and that just kills all the deals potentially going forward, because no one wants to get engaged with you if they know somebody else has the right to buy your company. So it's optimal if you can get the money with no strings attached, a lot of strings. That is something you just have to be very, very careful from.
Read those agreements.
Right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm sorry I have to leave. One of the things that venture capitalists is supposed to do is we're supposed to be able to introduce you to Fortune 500 companies, and I've got an executive, from one of those companies waiting for me. I don't want to piss him off.
So let me shift the discussion to, let me ask if you guys are interested in talking about this.
something that I frequently hear, I'll give you an example. Before I came to ACDC, I was actually doing private equity for a telecom fund, so I was a good capital. And I would like explain what I do to my family, and they thought it was illegal. Nobody in my family knew of venture capital. So I'm just wondering, would it be useful to talk about how do you find VCs, how do you find angels? Is anybody interested in that at all? Okay, who would like to tackle that?
Certainly, I'll put a plug in for the NBAI as a great source of angels looking to scratch a deal. Several sites here in town. I'm not sure, haven't been to AtlantaAngels.com and some of the others recently. But I remember years ago they used to list angels, often limited partners who sit on their boards for bigger deals as well. There's a couple of investment forums. Ben and others can speak better to them, that meet monthly, that attract a large group of angels. One that meets not too far from here over at GCAT. Something.
Yeah, there are a number of regular monthly venture seances, I call them. We have a bunch of people that get around and have super deals for set in. Get all the investors liquored up and think they get excited about a deal. some of those can be productive, but just to find those forums, ACDC has a lot of resources that would point you in the right direction. Oftentimes, the lawyers are integral to that process, so depending on which law firm you're working with, some in Atlanta particularly, there are five or six firms that are sort of very plugged into the venture community have been very good at getting their clients in front of investors, and if you've been lucky to attach yourself to one of those, then that's a big step forward there. Sometimes your accounting firm as well, although early on, you may not have as much need for an accounting firm as you do for a very capable lawyer, but certainly recommend that route.
Okay. And thanks for the plug, Ben. So www.apdc.org, and you go to our website, and there should be a link to the Entrepreneur Resource Center, and you should be able to find resources to help you in that endeavor. How are you doing on time?
We've got about
5 more minutes. Okay. I think I've ignored this side of the room for a while. Anybody over here? Okay.
Yes, my name is Brian. I'm from TGF, and in that family is a business organization for professional athletes. My question was, I was going to segue what Alan said earlier about the general manager. Professional athletes, there's a paradigm shift now, becoming investors and entrepreneurs. And my question to the panel is, have you worked with any professional athletes, and how do you handle individuals who have money already and or celebrities? Because there's a paradigm shift. It first started about 5 years ago, but now with the help of PBSN, we launched a publication to help further that. How do you handle the situation, and have any of you came across a situation working with an athlete more or less as a celebrity in that particular phase of venture capital? Because the perception is that athletes have money already, and because of the lifespan of career, sometimes for sure, and probably around 4 years. So how would you handle a situation?
Let me ask this question just to clarify, because I know some folks like Joe Montana, Ronnie Lott, they're investors in funds. Are you talking about from an investor, a limited standpoint, or the actual?
I'm not talking about Ronnie, Joe, and Mark.
Okay.
They own a fund that they're starting. Mainly talking
about the entrepreneur.
As an entrepreneur.
Okay, gotcha.
One single athlete or a small group of athletes having an idea or concept they want to bring to market.
Gotcha.
How will a venture capital firm value or perceive that particular niche?
I don't think we would.
Look at it like any other idea, basically. I mean, it might be helpful if these athletes have, they might have more seed money, so they might be able to come up with a bigger idea and advance more rapidly based on the wealth they've created as athletes. But otherwise, I think it's going to fall in all the same criteria we've talked about so far. We have at Jackson got some very high profile people in the entertainment community involved in some deals we've looked at, so we're a little bit familiar with that, and a little bit with athletes too. So there's an opportunity to show these people with very high paying but fairly short career spans fields that build their net worth on a continuing basis over their lifespan. So we're trying to be as helpful with that as we can.
Okay. My name is Keith Wilson. I do public affairs consulting, and also have a company that helps growing and businesses keep or retain federal and state contracts and that sort of thing. But my question is, I'm looking at launching another venture, and I'm not quite sure where to find this house to serve the senior leadership on the team, if you will. What are some resources we can lay through this to find
On our end, two sources. Number one, literally going right to those key people that would be key competitors of that company that have really grown up and are doing well in the space. You know, what better place to attract the right people? And many of those individuals are looking for something, you know, have done well. They're senior executives. They've been paid well for a number of years. They're looking for that next level up, which might be just so happen to be maybe running that company or a part of that company. So that would be the best source. The second best source, believe it or not, is monster.com. We regularly advertise there for presidents, and you would just not believe the volume of applicants we get. Now there's a lot more weeding and sorting, lots of ineligible people applying for those spots. But if you've got the time to sit there and weed, it's a great source with lots of applicants.
Well, I guess I should put one caveat, and that is that a lot of the folks, I've tried that through the roof already, and those folks want your commitment. And they're like, tell me I'm going to make $200K, or tell me I'm going to make XYZ. I can't promise that, because the idea hasn't even been launched yet.
Try putting in the monster ad that they've got to make a financial commitment to you. They've got to buy into your company of maybe 100 or 200K, and then you can basically pay them out of the money that they put into it.
That will cut down the number of responses.
It sure does.
One last question. This is our last question, and then I think we're going to go over time, right? Okay, yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, John Adams, and Field Biosciences founder, manager in the biotech startup that focused on early stage, I focused on large molecules of research for cancer care. My guess, two questions quickly. What's your current perception of the climate for biotech? Not biomedical devices, not genomics, not proteins. Okay. Not within your respective firms, generally. I'm giving you more generous. Two, what relates to the question of management and control? A lot of things were said, some words like chemistry and you have to find the fit, that sort of thing. A lot of that's supposed to check. I understand that there's elements of receiving and all decision making. What do you do? What criteria can we control to maximize chance of being in a favorable position for the management decisions made and by the VC type of relationship? Great question.
One of the most important things we've learned over time is to not invest where we don't really know the space. And typically, especially within some very technical areas of the of the medical side, you literally have to have some PhDs on staff to really know what is valuable, what can be licensed or sold to another large company, or the Pfizer looking for that edge or that requirement. We don't have that competency on staff, and so we've done very few.
Ditto. I mean, I think it's important to look. I mean, biotech is very hot and sort of has replaced the information technology space. I think it's the hot venture sector, but we don't look at it at all because we just don't really know anything about it. So I think the key is to find a fund that specializes in it and can kind of get the science behind it and has deep pockets, because it takes a lot of money to get products to market or get your research to a commercial point.
Okay, bioscience is very difficult in Atlanta. I know the Georgia Research Alliance has just put together a bunch of recommendations for the governor to try to address that issue, but Norrell Mosley has done a little bit of life science investing. HIG has a life science guy in Palm Beach that comes up here once in a while. We've got a few firms in the research triangle, but it's really there's so little resident life science money in Atlanta. This is not a great place to raise money for that. It's almost inevitably going to be in San Diego or the Northeast or Silicon Valley
or RTP.
And there is a lot of expertise where I'm from, and I mean I'd be happy to share.
Yeah, so that is an unfortunate shortcoming here, because we have so many eminent scholars. This is a big deal at Emory. You all read about the last week or two where they sold the rights to the drug, and quite a bit of money generated there. I mean, there's some great work being done at Georgia Tech, and a lot of that combined with Emory. But it's a shame that we don't have resident money here that really knows that space, and we don't have an easy way to correct that.
And Nemo, can you take a shot at, so from an objective standpoint, what can a founder, CEO founder, do to maintain that role, maintain that title?
Hit your business plan, hit the numbers. I mean, you're asking how to defend your position.
From the initial position, the initial marriage, like term sheet, let's say one of the terms, it's like the miracle subject. All right, with your managed part, blank concept, blank projection. But let's say, to avoid the question mark when it comes to managed. I don't know. We kind of condition on this versus, we'll go with this and see what happens.
I solicit feedback preliminarily before you go see the VC firm from friends, family, other professionals in the community, and say, hey, what do you think about my plan? Do I have some gaps, holes to fill in the management team? What do you think? But the VC will probably recommend a solution. And if it's one, as part of the requirement or part of the proposal, as a condition to the financing, you go out and hire a COO, you need to hire a CFO. That's pretty common in conventional financing.
And I would add this. Take your founder hat off, put your investor hat off, because you have significant equity ownership in your company, right? What kind of senior management do you need for this company to move forward? And then how does that match with your experience and skills? So, the first step is self-awareness. And do you have the current capabilities, or can you grow to that? And I think that just doing that first step, I think, is going to make these discussions moving forward much easier as you explore the issues.
Oh, yes, Alex. There's nothing you can put in a VC contract up front that guarantees you'll be the management. I mean, life is very uncertain. These ventures are all so uncertain that nobody knows how they'll play out. And there'll be market forces you don't expect, other calamities or good things that happen. You just don't know what's out there in the future. So you've got to take some risks, I think. You just have to proceed on the presumption that you're working with good people and they're going to make logical decisions that are in your best interest as an investor, owner, founder, whatever. But you can't really get a no-cut contract up front. You always expose when you take in partners of any sort. You've got to be at some risk for that.
Well, great. Yeah, I'd like to thank the panelists for your participation.
And between your mother